if you believe assault is an act, not an adjective, your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. What do you believe? Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everybody. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio, Republic Broadcasting Network. Thank you very much once again to RJ Hinder and crew for setting up another fine show, sending your audience off to here. And we'll be sending all of the 2A listeners off later, at the end of this show, to the Global Research Hour. And then, of course, the always entertaining Ernest Hancock Show. So, just want to let you guys know, again, that for 8 measly American dollars, which 8 bucks today ain't what it was just a few weeks ago, but the cost has not changed. 8 bucks. You can get 100 generic quality RBN business cards to hand out to help spread the good word that we're spreading here on RBN. Hand those things out. For 100 of them, $8. Plus, you get a bumper sticker. And we're also going to throw in there a free copy of Aaron Russo's America, From Freedom to Fascism. If you have not seen that, it's a must for us like-minded people. It's a documentary. He goes out and he finds out a bunch of stuff that's going on, or rather unexplained, in the U.S. One of the things in particular is, go to the IRS, try to get an appointment with the commissioner and say, look, where is the law that says we have to pay taxes? Nobody will answer him. Nobody ever answers that question. So, you'll get some of the information there. And again, Dave Champion of the Dave Champion Show here on RBN. Again, that's 3 o'clock Central Time, Monday through Friday. He was one of Aaron's consultants on this. This is Aaron's last project. Now, Aaron was he's a big Hollywood movie producer. He had done you might remember Trading Places back in the day with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. Funny film. Still a classic. Aaron died not long after completing this documentary, America, Freedom to Fascism, from cancer. So this was his last project. He actually ran for governor in Nevada probably 10 years ago or so, and didn't come off really that great. Plus, he was here with California license plates, trying to run for Nevada governor and essentially trying to buy the office as it looked. However, he would have probably made a pretty darn good governor because the guy had his head on straight. So anyhow, for $8, you can get the 100 cards. You can get the bumper sticker and the DVD release of Aaron Russo's America, From Freedom to Fascism. Now, we've got several things that we're going to cover today, not the least of which has to do with, well, your rights. Something that's coming out of Alaska and several other states supporting the NRA as they are backing McDonald versus the city of Chicago, challenging the Chicago's anti-handgun laws, the handgun ban in Chicago, that should have been handled under Heller, but you have the stupid the Seventh Circuit there that says that only applied to federal territories, not to states, because the Second Amendment hasn't been incorporated under the 14th Amendment, which is stupid to me. Absolutely stupid. The 14th Amendment came well after the 1st through the 10th incorporation, my foot. It's an amendment. The Founding Fathers did it. Anyhow, more about that after we return. Stay tuned. I'll be right back.
QA Radio with Bill Carnes is live. 1-800-313-9443.
Welcome back. Okay, so we have this case, McDonald versus City of Chicago. And what it pertains to is this. When we had D.C. versus Heller, the decision came out in June of 08 that said that Washington, D.C.'s outright ban on handguns, and if you have a gun in your home, you can't have it ready to use for self-defense. It essentially made everyone defenseless with firearms. So the Supreme Court said on many levels all these things are illegal. So they're unconstitutional, can't do it. So the NRA immediately, as a matter of fact, later that day or the next, filed suits in several different other cities that had similar laws. Chicago's one of them that has essentially an outright ban on handguns. So this is now going to head in front of Supreme Court. It's going to be heard in February with an adjudication, a decision somewhere in May or June is when it's going to be expected. So what's happened is there's been dozens of states that have had their attorney generals send in a friend of the court brief. So here's one now out of Alaska. This is dated just, 3 days ago on December 7th. At the direction of Governor Sean Parnell, the state of Alaska announced last week that it has joined the legal battle to prohibit state and local governments from denying individual Americans their right to keep and bear arms, which is provided under the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. Attorney General Dan Sullivan of Alaska, along with his counterparts in three dozen other states, recently signed on to a friend of the court brief in the case of McDonald versus City of Chicago, now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Alaska has previously joined other states in successfully petitioning the court to hear the case, in which Chicago firearms owners challenge a handgun ban in the city. Last year, in D.C. versus Heller, the High Court overturned a similar handgun ban in the nation's capital, which is a federal enclave. That ruling did not resolve whether such a ban would be permissible when imposed by city governments or state legislatures. The right to keep and bear arms is so fundamental because, implicitly, it is the means through which all of our rights are secured, according to Alaska Governor Parnell. Whether in rural Alaska or inner city Chicago, this is a right Americans must have regardless of where they live or where they travel, as the governor continued. The Attorney General Sullivan of Alaska continues with, "We expect the gun owners to prevail in this case. The Supreme Court consistently has found that the individual rights in the Bill of Rights must be recognized by state and local governments thanks to the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. As Alaskans, whose way of life is dependent to such a large degree on the right to bear arms, it's important that we stand up for this principle." Now, here's an interesting thing. There's also been many district attorneys from different counties throughout the entire country that have signed on to this, including two or three dozen district attorneys out of the state of California. Now, these are generally not coastal, not some of them are, but generally not the coastal counties. However, one of the counties that signed on to it out of California was San Diego County, which of course is a coastal county. It's a most southwesterly county in the United States. Also, when there were places such as Kern County and I think Placer County, more of the internal counties. If you look at the red versus blue, the Republican versus Democrat in the maps out of California, you'll notice that the coast is heavily covered in blue, which would be the Democrats, and the red, which would be the Republicans, are all of the interior of the state. So there's more square miles of conservative people in California. However, the densely populated coastal areas are much more on the Democrat, aka liberal, side of things. However, even with that, there still have been many, many different district attorneys within the state that have signed onto the idea that, well, you know, it would seem as though, even though we might be anti-gun, perhaps we should actually follow the Constitution. Just perhaps. So, with that being said, we will see how these friend of the court briefs go. All right, that's really what we're looking for. Now, in other news, what we've talked before about how these gun-free zones, which are namely schools, workplaces, things of that nature, are the targets for a lot of the people that would be otherwise homicidal maniacs that get their hands on guns. Not gun owners that go to these places. No, no. It's the homicidal crazies that get a hold of guns and just want to unleash some sort of violence. Okay? You will find gun-free zones on, well, military bases, interestingly enough. We know that from Fort Hood, where the Obama administration, the Obama regime, pardon me, I didn't mean that slip, the Obama regime is dragging their feet on the investigation and doesn't want to call it an act of terrorism. Or they got rid of that, what do they call it now, a man-made disaster, right? Yeah, they don't want to classify it as a man-made disaster because of the Muslim in charge at the White House. Schools and workplaces. So Colorado State University is now going on the wrong side to ban guns from campuses out of Fort Collins, Colorado. Hunting season opened early for one Colorado college student today when the ruling board of governors at California State University voted to ban guns from campus. All right? So evidently there's not a state preemption law. They tried this at the University of Utah, in the state of Utah, and the governor got a hold of the chancellor of the school, the president of the school, and said, state law preempts that. You can't do it. Whether you like it or not, if they have a concealed weapons permit, they can bring them onto the campus. That's all there is to it. Now, Colorado State University, in exception to most colleges in America, has allowed concealed carry on campus since the state passed concealed carry legislation in 2003. Just over half of the campus population is of age to get a concealed handgun license, though no records were kept on how many students actually carried weapons to class. Now, under the proposed new ban, no student will be allowed to carry a weapon for self-defense, thus making it a gun-free zone or, in the eyes of a homicidal maniac, a target-rich environment. Yet again, they will not learn from history. You want to take these scuzzball idiots who are these Colorado State ruling board of governors and give them a history lesson. They seem to be good into education. Give them a bit of history and let them know how this sort of thing worked out at Virginia Tech and at Columbine in their own damn state. The current policy had been in place for over 6 years and had worked wonderfully, said Jim Manley of the SCCC state directors in Colorado. There's been no problem. Students were able to defend themselves on campus or off. Now, in fact, the ban is at odds with a resolution resoundingly passed by the CSU Student Senate, which endorses the pro-concealed carry policy. The students spoke up and told the college they supported the right to protect themselves, said David Burnett, a spokesman for the SCCC. Quote, now by putting their personal comfort ahead of students' needs, the colleges basically thumbed their nose at them. And what's more, they've imperiled the lives of thousands of college residents, employees, and visitors. Now, that's in Colorado. The opposite is happening now in Georgia. One piece of legislation coming from the members of the Georgia House of Representatives could be bearing on students' rights to bear arms. Now, State Representative Tim Bearden out of Georgia, Villarica, has been working on a piece of legislation that could affect students' ability to carry firearms and concealed weapons on campus. If passed, House Bill 615 would legalize the carry of concealed weapons in all areas of the state, including college campuses, with the exception of courtrooms, jails, and prisons. It's not like we want to be like the old West with everyone wearing a gun on their hip, said bill sponsor Bobby Reese of Sugar Hill, Georgia. But the Second Amendment strictly speaks to the rights of individuals to protect themselves. After the bill was introduced to the Georgia General Assembly last March, it never came to a vote. However, Bearden said it will receive another chance in January's congressional session. Though the bill is yet to receive the support needed to be passed, supporters say it's a matter of common sense. You can write all the laws you want, but the bad guys are going to carry guns, Reese said. Washington, D.C. banned all handguns, and the crime rate quadrupled. Law-abiding citizens must be able to defend themselves, he continues. So, we are seeing two opposite ends. One where guns were legal on campus, now they're looking to be made illegal. They've been illegal, now they're looking to be legal. Where would you rather go? Where would you feel safer? Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us right now. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
Okay, so out of Chicago, the holiday season is supposed to be a time when Americans reflect on the good things in their lives and give thanks for the blessings they've enjoyed during the year. In Chicago, however, the holidays are yet another time of murder and mayhem, despite the city administration's anti-gun laws and strict gun control. CBS2Chicago.com is again reporting on the violence plaguing one of the truly great cities of the world. We can't forget that Chicago is also one of the most anti-gun places in America, yet this past Thanksgiving weekend, it was drenched in blood. All told, 9 Chicagoans died in a bloody weekend that reflects the city's violence past and present. Here's part of the story out of that CBS group. It was a violent and deadly holiday weekend in the Chicago area, with 9 people reporting slain between Wednesday and Sunday night. The violence began around 5 p.m. Thanksgiving Eve when Sharon Moore, 18, was found lying on the ground with gunshot wounds in the hallway of a building on East 44th Street. Based on the rest of the report, the death toll reached a staggering 9 lives on a weekend where people should be celebrating, not murdering each other. On another note, this writer actually writes this. On a personal note, I spent the Thanksgiving weekend in the Chicago area with my family, and despite the holiday atmosphere, many parts of the city are gripped with fear. Not because of the threat of honest law-abiding people with guns, as Mayor Daley and his anti-gun groupies claim, but because of the never-ending threat of common criminals, thugs, and gangbangers who are the only armed people roaming the streets. Because a lot of those areas, the cops just don't want to go. Actually, that's not exactly true, the writer continues, since Chicago's aldermen have been long held the right to carry a concealed gun for their own protection while honest citizens go unarmed. An excellent op-ed by Steve Chapman laid out the story perfectly. Still, the joke has been made that many times that armed aldermen are simply an extension of the armed criminal element, but despite the possible truthfulness of the statement, it isn't really fair. What is fair, however, is to question why a group of politicians who were rightfully elected by the people of Chicago, or at least as close as you can get to being rightfully elected in Chicago, would have the audacity to disarm honest people who are choosing to carry a gun. The level of hypocrisy in Chicago politics has always been a step above most cities. But this is even starting in the home of the long-feared Democratic political machine. That's not a shot at Democrats. Other areas have had Republican machines. And place where voting is seen to be a civic duty, which is taken so seriously people continue to vote even after they die. So Chicago seems to be running neck and neck with Louisiana for the most corrupt political system. City of Chicago versus state of Louisiana. Anywhere, really, in Louisiana. So they're really kind of back and forth. You remember Rod Blagojevich, former governor, and now up on federal charges of Illinois, out of Chicago. You know the scuzzbag who is now in charge of the White House out of Chicago. So there's just a couple of ideas. One of the major problems in affecting change in Chicago, which is similar to the problems in Cleveland, Philadelphia, Boston, and other older established American cities, is that people are jaded to assume that politicians are willing to trample the will of the people without remorse. That jaded attitude allows people like Chicago Mayor Richard Daley to flaunt his armed bodyguards while demanding his citizenry go unarmed. The shame, this is just total hypocrisy, the shame of it is Mayor Daley knows his city is dangerous and that his constituency is at risk. He has long admitted to being incapable of protecting every citizen and blames private gun owners for the carnage, a laughable claim considering private ownership of handguns is heavily restricted in Chicago and, therefore, the mere possession of a gun makes the owner a criminal. Daley asserts any gun-related issue in Chicago is a gun crime, a situation that puts Daley and his minions on the city council in the envious position of writing laws that have only one outcome, and then using that outcome to their own political benefit. Wow, imagine that. Unfortunately, however, the complete lack of shame, decency, and morality shown by the city aldermen who carry guns while claiming guns are too dangerous for normal people is beyond contempt even for Chicago. Other cities would revolt under such an elitist system, yet inexplicably Chicago reelects Richard Daley and the aldermen, his co-conspirators, in election after election after election. There is good news, however, as the tide is turning in Illinois as police chiefs and sheriff's departments are now openly defying Mayor Daley and pushing the will of the people by supporting legal concealed carry. I cannot wait for McDonald versus Chicago to get heard at the Supreme Court and a ruling to come out. Stay tuned, guys. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
All right. So what I want to do right now is I want to address the term called calling the shot or calling your shot. I've had a few inquiries. Okay, what is calling the shot mean? What does that term mean, and how do you do it, and what's a benefit? Okay, calling your shot is a term generally reserved to rifle shooting, like more longer range sort of thing. It could be for anything, however. So although it's generally pigeonholed into rifle shooting, it could be anything, including into archery. here's the deal. When you're ready to press off a shot or launch your bow, we're going to keep this to guns, but keep in mind, all this would transition into archery or bow hunting. All right. Here's calling your shot. You've got your sights aligned. You've got the front sight or the reticle of your scope set on the target. Your little breath control, you're pressing off a shot. Calling your shot means knowing right exactly where your sights were aligned at the instant the shot broke. So calling it means you know right where the sights were when the shot broke. So the bullet should be impacting pretty much at that same spot. Now, if you are setting up and you're going to sight in your rifle, and recently we have talked about different things about sighting in your rifles. So, if you're going to sight in your rifle, and you're going to do a 3 to 5 round group, right? 5 rounds is great. However, you can get by with 3 rounds, especially in today's day and age when ammunition is pretty expensive and getting more and more difficult to come by. So, go with 3 rounds if you need. You're going to set up. Let's say that you're going to sight in a rifle at 50 yards to get a good zero, and then you're going to back up to 200 to confirm it, all right? So, which is standard practice. So you get up at 50 yards, and for 50 yards you can use, as I've said before, any ammo. It doesn't really matter. You can be close there. When you go back to 200, use whatever ammunition you're going to go hunting with or normally use in this gun. If it is different, then, you know, the cheaper stuff. If it's a round that you're always going to use, no big deal. If you're going to use some expensive hunting ammo, you can sight in at 50 with the cheaper range stuff, and then when you get back to 200, confirm it and really get it dialed in from there. So here's what calling your shot would be. Is an example. You're laying prone. You've got your gun on a rest or on a bipod. By the way, if you're using a rest, so you've got an ammo can and a sandbag or one of those rabbit ear sandbags, rest it on the fore end of the gun, not the barrel. Do not rest the barrel on something when you're shooting. Rest the fore end, the fore end of the stock. Okay, that's what gets rested. That's where bipods should be attached, not to the barrel. Changes the harmonics on the barrel, change a little bit of pressure in the barrel. You're going to get just horrible accuracy issues in most cases. I actually saw a guy that had an M1A, a Springfield M1A, that had been accurized, if you will, threw a lot of money into it to make the thing shoot with match ammo 1 inch at 100 yards, 1 minute of angle. Then, and he sighted in off of a sandbag. Then, he attached a bipod to the thing that attached to a nut on the barrel. And it was now shooting 6 minutes of angle, or a 6-inch group at 100 yards, because that changed the harmonics. Okay, so that, understand that sort of thing goes down. So, you're sighted in, you're ready to go, you're behind the gun, you breathe in, breathe out, some carbon monoxide now about to be regulated by the EPA comes out, and you start adding pressure. At that momentary pause, the respiratory pause, where you're done breathing out and haven't yet begun to breathe in, 3 to 5 second pause, you get the shot to break. If you're looking through the scope or looking through the sights, you would call your shot. The way to do that is you have a copy of the target that you're shooting at, or a data book, if you happen to have a data book. That's for another discussion sometime. You have that next to you and a pencil to write on it with your shooting hand. So you fire the shot. Wherever your sights were at the instant that the shot broke, you would mark that in pencil or pen, whatever you've got, and then put a number by it, like first shot. Okay, the sights were right here when it went off. Great. Then we're going to go into shot 2, shot 3, and so on. And what you're doing there is you are calling your shot. Calling your shot is, where were the sights as you had them in your line of sight, in your vision, at the instant the shot broke? That is calling your shot. Why is that important? Let's say you're sighting in at 50, right? And you're doing a 3-round group. And one of them, the shot goes off a little bit early as you were exhaling. The sights hadn't yet come back up to the target. As you inhale, Normally, your sights are going to dip. As you exhale, they're going to rise. Sort of thing. The sights go down, up, down, up. And when they're up at that momentary pause, they're at the top of the peak, and that should be where you're dialed in. Or maybe you press the trigger and you make it go a little too hard. Or you're pressing so slowly that at this momentary pause, you're dragging it out. Now you're starting to get these fishy eyes and your vision's going a little blurry and fishies are floating around in front of your pupil. Well, you don't want to take the shot. You want to back off the trigger and start this process. Get a couple of good deep breaths in there and then start the process over. Have the shot break. The thing is to know right where your sights were at the instant the shot broke and mark it down. Mark it down on your little target or your data book. Have a copy of the target next to you or a smaller version of it. Or just, you know, outline on a sheet of paper what the target looks like. It's a bullseye or a diamond or whatever. And then mark, you know, one, two, three. You don't actually have to put a circle and mark it. You just mark it with a number, a small one, a small two, a small three, whatever it is, whichever shot you fire. When you go downrange and you check your target, or if you look at it through a spotting scope, you should see where the target, the holes in the target, should match your call target. Okay, well, however you called it, shots 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Where you have those numbers or dots and numbers written on your target that you're writing on as you're shooting, your target downrange should mimic that. If not, and it might mimic it in pattern, but off to one side or high or low or whatever, which means you need to adjust. Now that you've called your shots, what you need to do is say you're shooting a three-round group, and all of them were good, or you're shooting a three-round group, and one of them you threw one of the shots, or you threw two of the shots. The target's now, it's useless. You have to have at least three good shots where you called the shot, and the front sight, at the moment that the trigger broke and the round was fired, all should be at essentially the same spot on the target. When you look at where the holes are, you have to get the average of where those at minimum of three rounds lie, horizontal and vertical. Find out where the center of that group is. That is your average. Now you take the center of that group to the center of the target, then you would adjust your sights accordingly. Perhaps it's high by an inch and left by 2 inches. You need to figure out what the adjustments are on your scope or on your rear sight or on your front sight, whatever it is that you need to adjust on your particular gun. There's so many differences, we don't have time to get into them right now. You would adjust your sights or your reticle to the point of bringing it to the right 2 inches and down 1 inch, if that were the case. If you're shooting at 50 yards, all of the scope measurements are done usually are done at 100-yard increments, so you have to double that. If it's a quarter minute of angle, that means four clicks means 1 inch at 100 yards. Well, if you need to move 2 inches at 50 yards, that would equal 4 inches at 100 yards. So whatever the adjustments are, you need to double. You get it? If you're at 50 yards and you have a scope or a rear sight which is set up for increments at 100 yards, you need to double that at 50. Keep it right on at 100, half it at 200. You get the math here, I hope. So, once you're done at 50 and you've got this thing, it shouldn't be close, it should be dialed in at 50. When you go back to 200, you're going to have to make a couple more adjustments, almost always. Throw in the ammo you intend to use with this gun for whatever exercise you're sighting in for. And again, I use 50 and 200. That's generally where people will sight in because the trajectory of the bullet will cross the line of sight in most rifles, most calibers, at 50 yards and then again at 200. From the muzzle out to 50 yards, the bullet will appear to impact low of the line of sight. From beyond 50 yards out to just shy of 200 yards, it will appear to impact high of the line of sight, the highest portion of that arc being at about 110 yards. So at 50 and 200 is where the line of the bullet travel will intersect the line of sight at both spots, give or take a couple of yards, but that's where most people will sight it. So you go back to 200, load in the appropriate ammo, the ammo for the gun, the ammo for the hunting trip, whatever it is, the ammo that you're going to carry for this gun. Load it up. Have your target downrange. Have your call target next to you. If you're right-handed, you're going to be riding with your right hand. If you're left-handed, you're going to be riding with your left hand. Have it all set up. Get behind the rifle. Get a good natural point of aim. Okay, you got this thing set up on a bipod or on a sandbag. Some sort of rest. Again, attached to the forend, the stock's forend, not the barrel. And get your natural point of aim. That means breathe in, breathe out, adjust a little bit. From there, close your eyes, breathe in, breathe out, open your eyes, make sure you're still sighted and on target. If not, adjust at the hips incrementally, very, very small adjustments. Okay? Close your eyes, breathe in, breathe out. Do that a couple of times, make sure you've got your natural point of aim so you're not fighting to keep this rifle on target. As fatigue sets in, it's going to set off. You don't want that to happen. So breathe in, breathe out, start pressing at that momentary pause. The respiratory pause at the bottom of the respiratory function. Get that surprise break. Bang. Then goes bang. Try a couple dry clicks, right, before you load up and go bang. Then call the shot. Shot one. This is where the sights were when it went off. Then shot two, shot three. If you want to go up to five shots, do it. You need to have a minimum of three shots. Five is plenty if you go for more. To ensure that you've got a good group to go after. Then through your spotting scope or walking down to the target, figure out where the center of that 3 to 5 round group is, where the average is. Again, if you called a shot that was off, disregard that and follow another shot in replacement of that. Unless you've already got at least three good shots, you don't have to fire anymore. If you're firing a 5-shot group, you got 4 good ones and one of the 5 was bad, say shot number 2 was bad, whatever, then just disregard shot number 2. You still have to plot it. You still have to call it on your call sheet. Then find out where the average of that is. Make your adjustments appropriately. Again, if you have a scope or a sight which is adjusted at 100-yard increments, that's the way the manufacturer put the increments in there. Say it's a 1 minute of angle at 100 yards or a quarter minute of angle at 100. Whatever it is, you need to half it for 200 yards. If you're 1 inch off at 200 yards, well, you would go half the adjustment of 1 inch at 100 yards. Follow me? I hope so. At 400 yards, it would be 1/4 the adjustment at 100 yards. At 25 yards, it would be 4 times the adjustment at 100 yards. I hope everyone's following this math. Okay? So, once you've got the adjustment made, then you go through the exercise again, and you confirm the sight-in. All right? Calling the shot is of utmost importance when it comes to sighting in a rifle. Also, it's of utmost importance when you're hunting. Let's say that you're out and you're on a deer hunt or an elk hunt or a moose hunt or maybe you're hunting cougars or something, whatever you're hunting. Calling the shot is important because you want to know that you hit the animal. If you've just got the thing sighted in and bang, you fire off around and the thing takes off. And you have no idea if you hit it or where you hit it, you could spend a fair amount of time hunting large, wounded, dangerous game when you're not sure where you hit the thing or even if you did. Maybe you're out hunting some sort of cougar or mountain lion. You're not sure if you hit it or not. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. But the cat took off. And you go and hunt this wounded animal down, and you've got it backed into a corner, it might have just enough to say, you know something? I'm not going down without a fight. And now you're mauled by this big cat. Or you're racked up by the antlers of this particular wild cow, be it a deer or an elk or whatever. Some buck is going to trample you. You know, statistically speaking, more people in America get wounded and killed by deer than any other animal in the wild, percentage-wise. Bambi. Well, Bambi's daddy, actually, the bucks. Because you're out there hunting them, oftentimes during the rut, they're all excited and happy and willing to defend everything around them. More people in the wild get injured by deer than any other animal in the U.S. People take them for granted. Don't do that. Anyhow, if you're able to call the shot, you should be able to know where you hit the animal. If you hit them in a good chest shot, you should know, all right, I'm going to follow the blood trail. They shouldn't be too far. If they moved or you shanked the shot or something went down that was wrong, you might have an idea. Okay, well, you know, I hit him in the lower rear leg. Okay, well, you know, this animal's suffering. You got to get up there. You got to find this animal. You got to put him down and end the suffering. It's responsibility to have good working equipment, know how to use it, make sure it is sighted in, and make sure you're not taking a shot beyond your ability or your practice or anything that you can guarantee, and call a good, solid shot. Once you can call a shot on the range, it's easier to call a shot outdoors when hunting. And once you can call a shot outdoors when hunting, you can be sure that you are a good, safe, ecological hunter with ethics. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
All right, guys. So I have described this whole thing on... you can use the cheap ammo at 50 and then use your good ammo back at 200 and from there on. The reason being is this. If you have, for let's say, 308, right? A lot of people like to hunt with a 180 grain, say like a Remington PowerPoint or something like that. You can't go get a 150 grain full metal jacket like the yellow box stuff or some sort of otherwise practice or range ammo and expect to get the same trajectories as the heavier ammo. Okay, they fly at different velocities. They drop at the same velocity, or at the same rate, you know, 32 feet per second per second. However, they were going to travel different distances in that same amount of time. The heavier bullets will go further. The lighter bullets aren't going to go quite as far, but they're going to get there faster. See what I mean? So where the impact is quite a bit dramatically different. Now, if you're talking about taking a 200 or 300 yard shot, if you're good enough to take a good 200 or 300 yard shot, maybe even a 400 yard shot, with a good solid 308 or 30-06 on game, right scope, all that good stuff, and you sight it in, and you know you can do it, you can call your shot, you're ready to go. But you did all of your sighting with a 150 grain round, and now you're shooting 180 grain or 190 grain. Or a 200 to 210 grain round. Your bullet's not going to impact the same place that you had it sighted in for. Several different things will account for differences, even if you do sight in with the right ammo. One will be elevation, temperature, humidity, barometric pressure. All of these things play a role in trajectories and being able to get your round on target. Now, they're not going to make such a huge difference if you're sighted in, say, at your home range, out to 200 yards, you're not going to take a shot beyond 200 or 250 yards. You go up into the mountains, the conditions are different. You're still going to have a round impacting in the vital areas wherever you go, regardless of the changes. The only real difference is going to be if you're in rain or snow. Okay, that's really going to be the difference. Other than that, or you know, really heavy fog, maybe. But then you get to see the vapor trail. You never seen a vapor trail behind a bullet. It's cool. You know, just understand. That's why I say you've got to do your final sight-in, your heavy-duty final sight-in, your absolute confirmation with the stuff you're going to hunt with. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Folks, thanks for spending your day with me. Have a wonderful weekend, and stay tuned for the Global Research Hour coming up next, followed by Ernest Hancock.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.
I will not break. I will show.